stick to that too.
Okay, thanks. Always a pleasure to come to Santa Barbara. So I have three topics. One will be some work with Greg Agana from November on non-supersymmetric quadrangular to be turned there. Another will be some introduction to works of Acharya and Palandra on statistics and theory of magnification, various people on the Wolf, Cashew, Gavias, and Taylor on 2A, plus magnifications. And finally, if I have people are interested, this would also be informal, I'll talk about the question of principles that might select along the vernacular of string theory and the present sort of unsatisfactory state of that. So, yeah. Okay, so I've spoken, I think, maybe too many times about the general sort of context of trying to study the set of string vernacular and trying to characterize it as a sort of intrinsically interesting mathematical object and the possible phenomenological application. So I won't repeat that discussion. There's the possibility under extremely optimistic assumptions that one could make predictions from statistics of vernacular without other assumptions, except a very optimistic one about the number, which I'll very briefly summarize, just summarize a long discussion. So if somehow we could get some handle on the total number of distinct vernacular string theory and their breadth distribution, if they're uniform or otherwise, then there are various regimes which roughly say number of vernacular around 10 to the 10, 10 to the 100, 10 to the 1,000, or much larger, possibly infinite. And we don't know. It's very still early stages in trying to understand this. And just to briefly state what I think would be the qualitative consequences of this. Well, in this case, obviously, one doesn't have these statistical Weinberg et al. Arguments for solving the cosmological constant problem. And so string theory, for it to be a viable description of the universe, would still require a mechanism of some sort to solve the cosmological constant problem, or else it would probably be wrong. Okay, and then this is the case where you can imagine solving the cosmological constant problem, and the present status of things, we sort of think the number is this, or somewhat larger, thanks to Busso and Polchinski and my subsequent work. And this is the regime where I think you could reasonably hope to make predictions without further assumptions. And so this is certainly the most interesting case. And I'll talk a bit about predictions about the supersymmetry breaking scale. But as things get up much above this, so just to briefly state the idea, this is a regime where the distributions that we've been getting do produce under, say, one assumption, say, let's say, low scale supersymmetry breaking for purposes of definiteness, you would have enough vacua, more than 10 to the 120, say, to tune the cosmological constant. And under some other assumption, let's take the safest one, okay, where the argument is very simple. There's been, there's a very simple a priori argument that variation of constants, like the fine structure constant, is extremely hard to get out of compactification of string theory. Okay, so I wrote about this with Banks and Don. And the argument is simply that we know the effective potential is a function of the fine structure constant from known physics of effective field theory, and that the potential is set by a scale of at least, GeV, what we know the standard model, and we trust this dependence. And to get variation of the fine structure constant on cosmological time scales, you have to make the potential very flat, okay, for some significant variation. You know, 10 to the minus 5 was suggested some time ago, let's not believe. Something that requires tuning several coefficients of the Taylor series of expansion, that's something which would not be expected if there were 10 to the 100, 10 to the 200 vacuum. And so if you really saw this, this would also fall string theory. Okay. But on the other hand, suppose there are 10 to the 1,000 vacuum. Okay, well, who cares if you have to tune 8 coefficients of a Taylor series to, you know, 10 to the 60 or 10 to the 100 accuracy. Well, within 10 to the 1,000 vacuum, if you have a reasonably uniform distribution of these coupling, of these coefficients in the potential, well, you could get it, you know, out of 10 to the, let's say 10 to the 60 to the 8th power. That's really what you need if you orient that you're supposed to tune from some scale of supersymmetry breaking. Okay, with a sufficiently large set of vacua, you could not claim even that seeing this falsified the theory. And so this is an extreme example to show that once you start getting up around this number, the predictions all start to fail. Okay, prediction in the strong sense of string theory says you can't get X if you see X, you falsify string theory. And so this is the case where you really have to start talking about selection principles to have any hope of making strong predictions from the theory. But selection principles could easily get you down into these more interesting regimes. Okay, but as the number continues to grow, you're asking, of course, a huge amount from your selection principle to say that in the extreme case, we don't know that there aren't infinitely many vacua which are candidates. Well, you know, it has to be extremely strong selection principle to say that out of this infinite set, you really cannot ever get, you know, some large, you know, even that infinitesimal fraction of them that they survive, you know, then you know, you're still in trouble in terms of predictivity in the theory. So it's a very basic question, you know, just what is the even roughest estimate of this number of vacua, and that's the type of context you should keep in mind for the talk. Okay, so now the distributions of 2B flux vacua have been studied quite a bit now. I've reported my work with Genev, and some of this has been confirmed and worked on by other authors. So just to briefly repeat the setup of the problem. So we're going to have to find the 2B theory on a VR threefold, and you can think in the general framework of KKLT, but we won't use all of the features of that construction. So we have four dimensions, we have some chosen collabial, we can turn on boxes as described by Giddings, Bashir, and Polchinski. There are two sets of freeform boxes that we can turn on quantized amounts on any of the three cycles of the collabial. So we have this large set of vacua characterized by two times B3 integers, and because the vacuum energy now will depend, once you turn on these fluxes, depend on the moduli, this will typically stabilize all the moduli that for which the vacuum energy depends, in this case the complex structure moduli and dilaton. And that stabilization is usefully described in a limit of large volume loop string coupling in terms of an effective four-dimensional theory with this Dukov-Bopa Taylor-Wooden type of superpotential and a known Taylor potential, which you can derive using techniques of spectral geometry, the Taylor potential of the n equals 2 convectification with no flux. At least, you know, again, in some, you know, leading order approximation of, you know, very large coupling. Okay, so then one, for present purposes, just grants that one has a four-dimensional supergravity theory with complex structure moduli space dilaton as the configuration space, and this data as the supergravity theory. And one wants to study the distribution of supersymmetric vacuum solutions to EW equals 0 or non-supersymmetric vacuole solutions of mu prime equals zero, which are not solutions of this. And furthermore, here you might like to study the distribution of supersymmetry breaking scales, and I'll define that as the sum of the S squared and B squared breaking parameters. So the Gravitino mass would be this one of them. And, this one. Okay. So, so this you expect to find many solutions by this generic picture that you have as many equations as unknown. So sufficiently generic superpotential will fix all the moduli. And that turns out to be true. The 2B problem I should have mentioned has this nice a priori cutoff on the total amount of flux. It comes from the tadpole condition for P3 tadpole charge. So we'll call this number L. And this sets the total scale of the flux. And without this, the number of vacua would obviously be infinite. Worse, the number of vacua that stabilize you in some particular regime, you know, region of moduli space would also be infinite because you can just scale up the fluxes. And everything else, this equation is linear. This equation, you know, all the equations scale simply in terms of the scale of the flux. So you need a constraint like this to get a finite number of vacua. And the basic estimate of how many vacua there are has to do with the size of the parameters. It's analogous to the original ideas of Bussard and Polchinski to say that you might expect numbers of vacua in this problem to be roughly given by the volume of a sphere in this 2D three-dimensional flux space of radius square root of L. Okay, so that's the type of naive estimate you might expect. And fairly simple arguments, not going into any details of the problem, validate this to say that within this 2D three-dimensional space, you can look at the solution, you know, you can look explicitly at these equations, you can say, look at some region in the moduli space Z tau, and map that region into some region in flux space that stabilizes vacua there. And to the extent that that region is of the full dimension 2B3, then in the limit that the fluxes become extremely large, you can neglect the flux quantization condition. You know, equivalent, you know, that's intuitive. More precisely, what you're saying is you want to count quantiles, you know, lattice points within this region, some wedge inside the sphere with the constraint put on it here. And then as the radius of the sphere and the size of the region becomes really large, the number of lattice points in that region will be well approximated by the volume, and then that will close up as that. Okay, so that's the basic justification of this type of estimate and tells you that there's going to be corrections at order 1 over square root of L. Now, in fact, you can do much better than this and get the leading, the constant controlling this leading behavior of members actually, you can show that the correction is actually smaller than that. And,
the B3 factorial assumes the handles are all the same.
No. In fact, that's a very interesting point. The B3 factorial only came from the volume of the formula for the volume of the sphere. So, in fact, it assumes that all the handles are distinct.
Oh.
If all the handles were the same, there would be another factorial. Yeah, a very interesting point. Okay. So, you're anticipating. Yeah, no, it's really just the volume of the sphere formula that leads to this. Okay, so without going into a lot of detail about how one gets these results, because I've spoken about it here before, and people who want the details can talk to me afterwards.
Okay, so if B3 is like 500,
yeah,
and and L is less than 500.
Then you don't, then, that's right, then you don't trust this formula. This would be an asymptotic, as I told you, an asymptotic formula. It has been, you know, also looked at numerically, and it seems to be good for this, you know, range, you know, L, at least D3.
Okay.
Okay, and, if, you know, in fact, you might not have even believed it until it was a few times D3, but this has been looked at for these small number of moduli examples, and this is about where it starts to be valid. Yeah. No, there is actually no good result at the moment for the other regime. That's an interesting open problem. Okay, so the type of result one can get now is in this large flux limit, which, you know, covers, you know, you don't get to choose this parameter out, has to do with the tadpole charge, how many U3 rings you put in, but there's a sizable subset of examples where you satisfy this condition. And then you can approximate the sum over these lattice points by some integral over fluxes satisfying these constraints. And then the sort of thing that you would derive would be some density of vacua on the moduli space of, you know, whatever type you're interested in. Okay, and now it's supposed to be sum, you know, really that's going to be an integral for the calculation we're doing over the vacua, which are allowed there, and then effectively delta function of your constraint, so dw of z tau. And then this is a unit normalized delta function, so if you integrate this over some region in moduli space z tau, you get the number of vacua. Okay, and then if you try to be explicit about that, in terms of the usual physics definition of delta function, you have to put in a factor to cancel the Jacobi of the change variables from the dw to the z tau, which is this data of the matrix beyond z. Okay, so that would be a density of supersymmetric vacua, which you could then integrate to get this coefficient of the leading term. And now there are two simple answers, and then there's a lot of very complicated further refinements of this you can get. Okay, so for all these problems, it's easier to get this quantity, okay, which is a sort of index that counts vacuum with signs plus or minus depending on the sign of this determinant, which you can think of various ways. I mean, one way to think of it is that you're doing Morse theory for the function e to the k absolute w squared. So a critical point of that is the same as a critical point in dw as long as w is not zero. And now you're weighing into the plus or minus sign in a way that cancels pairs of vacua like this. So this is a problem which on the face of it depends. You can vary the Taylor potential, you vary this function in some arbitrary way, because the Taylor potential is not holomorphic, and start creating pairs of vacua. And by this device of weighing thing, you've compensated for that to some extent. The simple variations of this sort you can make cancel out of this quantity. And it's also a lower bound for the number of vacua. And it's also much easier to compute, because you don't have these absolute values. As soon as you start doing these calculations, it becomes clear. This is also familiar in, you know, the related matrix model, and that's matter types of, you know, random potential problems. Okay, so this index is the simpler thing to compute, and the basic result for it is that it goes very generally in this set of problems where you have twice as many fluxes. Okay, so just to shortcut a lot here, what's sort of, you know, important in qualitatively is the number of fluxes compared to the number of moduli you're trying to stabilize. Okay, so one of the qualitative features of the answer is going to turn out to be that indeed you can find back here where this parameter, the ADS cosmological constant at this stage at the beginning, is fairly small, and that's because you have more fluxes to tune than moduli to stabilize. You have B3 over 2 minus 1 complex. You have B3 minus 2, I'm sorry, what's the total time? B3 over 2, complex moduli, B3 real moduli, to stabilize, twice as many fluxes. And very generally, if you probably have many more fluxes than moduli, you get a density, which is the factor I just described, from pi, which significantly help you. So this is one of the reasons, perhaps, that you just need this condition. Okay, this quantity, m plus 1, is for B3 over 2, has to do with the number of moduli now. And then determinant of r plus omega, where this is the Taylor form on the complex structure of dilaton moduli space that we're stabilizing. This is the curvature derived from that Taylor form by the usual rules. This is the curvature, matrix of curvature two forms, and we dot that into the omega times the matrix one, and then take the determinant of that n plus one dimensional matrix. And then that is a density, that is a 2n plus 2 form, which expresses the local number of vacua weighed by these signs in some region of moduli space. Okay, so it's a nice and relatively simple calculation, but I've spoken about it here before. And it's similar to what you might have thought as the kind of null result, which we just did the volume for. Okay, so if you had to guess some answer knowing nothing about the other structure of the problem, you might guess that it's the density of vacuum proportional to this volume form of moduli space. But it has this interesting correction term, which comes very directly from the fact that derivatives are showing up in here. And that, for example, means that certain physically interesting regimes, such as you approach a conifold point, because basically the gauge coupling is very quick linear at that point, you find that this curvature term blows up. So you get a significant enhancement of the number of vacua at the conifold point. In fact, qualitatively, what you get is essentially the prediction from, let's take z to be a coordinate approaching some conifold point. Well, a physical way of thinking about that limit is that there can be some duality to a gauge theory where instead of stabilizing by flux, you have some dual gauge theory, the dual to this flux vacuum. And this is going to be the dynamically induced scale, the gauge kind of effect, particularly in examples. And then you might have said, well, now the natural distribution of parameters, suppose I think of stabilizing the original coupling constant of the gauge theory, well, then there's a dimensional transmutation, and I get a log scaling for the, I get a log uniform distribution for this ultimate scale parameter. And so I might predict something like d2z over z squared. Okay, so the fact that it's complex and the fact that it really looks like this, you would have to get into more detail to understand. But the rough fact that it has this divergence, you could predict physically on this ground. If you were stabilizing the gauge coupling and then running it through the usual asymptotic fusion and generation of exponentially small scale, this is what you would get.
Are there curvature squared corrections to that formula, or is that supposed to be exact?
Well, okay, I mean, again, in the regime that we compute this, it's certainly exact. Now, whether there's some sort of universal corrected, I mean, if you could calculate, corrections in any given problem, you would certainly get corrections to these formulas. But whether there's anything universal there, there's no evidence. Now, there's actually sort of a simpler mathematical argument. It's sort of, this is exact in the sort of sense of random systems, okay, where, Gaussian, unitary ensemble is exact, right, quite exact. It's sort of the universal limit of many, matrix problems is a Gaussian unitary ensemble that's determined by the symmetry. And similarly, in this case where you have more fluxes than moduli in those special symmetry problems, this is the universal limit. As you start putting in more and more fluxes, you'll approach this better and better. So I think the right answer to your question is no, but that's what I just said is more. Yeah. Okay, it's not the only universal thing you can get. I'll mention another one. momentarily.
Also, I'm having trouble visualizing, I mean, you're counting these extrema now according to sign.
Yeah, that's right. Now you might worry whether this is drastically underestimating. And you can get formula for the guy with the absolute value. They're just so much more complicated that I'm not going to bother writing
them. I'm having trouble picturing a function which has a lot more extrema which are positive than negative.
Well, if you just add lots of little wiggles on small scales, then you would drastically increase the total number of vacua and not change the index.
Right, because you're getting a large index.
Yeah, we're already getting a large index, and then you can get results which strongly suggest that basically the only way you could really get a huge number more of actual vacua would be lots of wiggles on very small scales, and physically the way you would do small scales are things like this. And then this doesn't do it. This actually directly contributes. You know, this is a simplified limit where you can check this is all directly contributing to the index. So for that reason, I think it's only been done explicitly in like, you know, 1 and 2 parameter problems. Where it's true, but for that reason, I think more generally, this is a reasonably good estimate. You know, the total number of vacua is not going to be some, you know, order one constant times.
Do you have an example or a picture of just an ordinary function of several variables and which has a lot of extrema which are minima and very few which are maxima?
So why you're asking? Well, let me just conclude because I didn't get to the conclusion of the current topic, but what you asked is a good question, yeah. So I'll come back in a second. Okay, so anyhow, the important thing to note about this is, of course, if you had, you know, integrated this near the conical point, it would have diverged. Okay, and so it would have immediately led to accumulation of vacua producing arbitrarily small scales, and there are various infinities at this point that you might distinguish. So there's a sort of mild infinity that says that there's an infinite number of vacua, but by putting some obvious physical cutoff, you know, that, you know, you could verify in real world physics, you can throw away infinitely many and get back to finite. So the basic example of that would be, suppose the number of vacua is infinite, but all but a finite number have volume of the extra dimensions, or, you know, Kluge-Klein scale, greater than some V star. So as soon as you say, you know, Kluge-Klein scale is, you know, X, you know, 10 to EV or whatever, you know, then, you know, or higher, then there's a finite number of vacua. Then you're not so much bothered. You know, there might be cosmological questions of how do you actually get into the vacuum we see, but for this more basic question of, well, how many string vacua match the physics we see, it's obvious that this infinity doesn't match. So you threw them out pretty quickly. But suppose there's some subsector of this complicated co-op. Yeah, and just by making choices within this little subsector, then you manage to get an infinite number of vacua. Okay, well, now I would say you're generally in big trouble because this could be a hidden sector. You don't see it directly, but it is going to make small corrections to the physics that you do see, and I think it's going to make small corrections to the cosmological constant. So you're clearly going to lose all arguments based on difficulty of tuning the cosmological constant and so forth. You are going to have an infinite set of vacua that you can't quickly rule out. Of course, you might think of some way of ruling them out, but on the level we got to so far, this would be an example of something that you could not quickly rule out, you know, this infinite value choice in the hidden sector. But this will be a big problem. Now, it's fortunate that you actually do the calculation, and what you get is this. Which is just barely normalizable. Okay. Now, what is the deep reason for this? I don't know, except for the fact that, you know, we had some finiteness here, but this finiteness is kind of tricky. You know, this is finiteness because this quantity in itself is not positive definite. It's once you say we are getting supersymmetric vacuum and so forth that you can start to use this. So it is true in the end that you get this finiteness. But I don't know any kind of deep, you know, reason why it has to be finite. It could be that you just keep doing these problems, and, you know, one of these will turn out to be infinite, and that will, if not spell the end for predictive constraint theory, it will certainly make the type of program I'm describing far more difficult to do anything with. Okay, but so far, every place where I've gotten far enough, you know, it turns out to be fine. Okay, so now to come back to your question, why? Okay, why are there so many vacua? And the most obvious thing to say is, again, you know, following Lucille and Polchinski, there's a lot of choices of flux. Now, Before we get to that, actually, there's another relevant question, which is that I still have not proven to you that there's a large number of accurate, because the final step in this step.
Well, actually, on this quadrangle's question, so this is a lower bound on the number of accurate because you're pointing out this is an index.
Oh, yeah, but for the conical, you can check. You know, it really, all the vacua become plots and something. Yeah, so it's clear in that case. It's actually very easy.
Okay, so
yeah.
You take both plus and one if you don't.
No, definitely all the vacua become plots as you approach it. Basically, the possibility of plus and minus, of course, essentially has to do with supergravity. You know, if this were ordinary supersymmetry, then all vacua would be plots. And as you approach a field theory limit, things become supersymmetry and not supergravity. So very generally.
Sorry, no.
Yeah. It had to do with the K sitting in this formula. You know, to the extent that it's just, you know, ordinary derivative of W, you know, you could forget the K here and then all the vacuum plus. Okay, so so that's not a problem, but indeed it has to do with the sum of the fluxes and, you know, some of the details that, that lead to this finiteness. So I would not say that it's obvious that such things will be finite. Okay, so now why is it so big? Well, I should point out to you that I didn't prove it was so big yet, because there is actually a further question, which is that if you actually now integrate this density over the moduli space, how do you know it's not extremely small? Okay, well, yeah, why should it be extremely small? Shouldn't it be order one? Okay, well, here it now comes back to your comment. Okay, well, here's this complicated, now let's take the quintic, you know. Quintic has 204 three cycles, but the only real geometric structure, the only topological structure on these cycles is the intersection form that tells you that, you know, some cycles are A and some cycles are B. And there isn't any other topological structure that tells you, you know, this cycle is, you know, this particular cycle. It's only where you are in the moduli space and the volumes of the different cycles that you distinguish them. There's nothing a priori. And so based on that observation, you might now say, well, you know, maybe there's actually a symmetry of the problem that allows me to put pairs of cycles. You know, for every A cycle, there's a B cycle, and that's determined. But maybe every A, B pair can be permuted, and I should get a factor of 1 over 102 factorial from there. Okay, and it's not this factor, which is actually just coming from the calculation of the volume of the sphere. Okay, so one has to take the possibility of that seriously. Okay, so how do you check it? Well, you actually compute the synodal. Okay, so this is a valid duality symmetry of the problem, but it's only a valid duality symmetry if you do the same permutation of the moduli. You know, so you have to permute pairs of cycles and you take the, you know, the coordinates or basically the volumes of the A cycles, the complex volumes, and you have to permute those the same way. And so the way that you fix this symmetry is you, the simplest way is to go down to some fundamental region of the moduli space, like the fundamental region of SL2Z in a familiar example. And having done that, you've fixed the symmetry, and then you can still sum or integrate over all the fluxes. I mean, you could do other things in general, but nobody knows how, you know, these groups act in complicated problems. But you do know what is the fundamental region of the moduli space, because it's just to say that what is the quintic? The quintic is some, you know, quintic polynomial equals zero, and then different choices of these different coefficients are different quintics up to an overall action of GL phi, just a linear redefinition of the coordinates. Okay, and otherwise they're different quintics. So there is a fundamental region, which you know. This is the possibility of some further discrete identification, but it's actually not present. That's harder, but that would be sort of order one back. Okay, so you could do it. You could do the integral, and now what is the volume of the quintic moduli space? Well, there is a mathematician not too far from me named Zichen Liu who claims to be able to do this calculation, but he hasn't published, okay, because he's a mathematician. And it's very tricky, and he hasn't proven all the ingredients, but he thinks this is the answer. And the answer is that you integrate the volume form, which is the Kähler form, to the 101 power over 101 factorial, because that's, you know, you have a convergent torque factor when you wedge. You know, omega is like, you know, some EZ, EZ bar, those are the locally accessed. So you have to cancel the convergent torque factor from wedging these together in different orders. And what does he get? He gets 1 over 5 to the 24 times 101 factorial. Okay, so the volume of quantum moduli space is exceedingly tiny in a way that sort of matches up with this intuition. Okay, so what does that mean? Okay, well, as you might notice, the quantity here is not this. Okay, so the R is one difference, but it also doesn't have this factorial in the denominator. And so you don't get, okay, so the analogs, we haven't done this. It may be doable, but this guy grows. The key thing in doing this calculation is to know that as you're approaching singularities in moduli space, basically there's a total derivative that vanishes. I mean, he's showing that it's not true for this. And he thinks, you know, but then I won't put words in his mouth as far as this one goes. So it might be possible to do this, but that's not the main reason for the difference. The difference is that the thing you're actually interested in doesn't have this extra factorial factor. And what it is to say is that it's the volume. Okay, so what is this volume factor? Okay, it's basically to say that the natural scale of variation of a potential that comes out of supergravity is M Planck, which we've said to one implicitly in our discussion. It's to say that you know, there might be other structure in the problem, but if there isn't, potential is just going to have variation on scales M Planck anyways. And so you roughly expect there to be one volume per one vacuum per M Planck to the n, you know, to the two, you know, yeah, to the two n, you know, the complex dimension piece of this moduli space. Okay, so here's cells, in fact, you know, maybe two pi to do this argument better. So there are kind of cells in the moduli space, or the Lorentz space, and you expect to find one vacuum in each of these cells, and it's much greater than this volume. Well, I'm not saying a lot. Okay, I mean the difference between the volume. Okay, so I just tried to say there was one per unit volume, and now I'm saying that that intuition is not right, because what there is it's much more analogous to the problem of not saying that there's one unit for volume, but saying that you're solving these n equations, okay, dw equals zero. So you can imagine writing out n, let's just be, you know, much more simple-minded and say you have a polynomial potential on some much simpler space. If w was a polynomial of degree d plus one, then you would have a bunch of equations of order degree d, and the number of solutions that you would expect of an equation like this would go as d to the n. You're simultaneously solving n d degree equations, and this is a general formula. And it's really this number which is showing up in the problem. So the more general version of that is this sum. Okay, so it's actually not the volume, okay, something which I've said is a nice physical analog in previous papers. That's why I'm tempted to keep repeating it. But the actual number is perhaps more usefully thought of this way, as the size, you know, the distances in this moduli space, you know, the size in some sense of the fundamental region in each direction in units of 2 pi and Planck is the analog of this degree d of the polynomial equation, and now you're solving those d equations, so you get a factor like d to the n, which also grows factorially, and then that would be times the volume, so you're compensating that.
Solutions are fairly dense in moduli spaces, is that what you're saying?
The solutions are many per volume if you measure density that way, but not necessarily if you measure density in terms of the distance to the nearest solution. But that's a, you know, this is another Yeah, no, no, it should be.
So it still is per one unit volume, so.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're just naively worried that you're going to decay like crazy.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's quite right. I think that is a.
The same geometry varied for fluxes.
Right.
Well, you see, it's confusing. The other reason it's confusing is that for any given, you see, it's not true that, you know, say this is identified with that, okay? Because what really happened is that when you cross over into the next fundamental region, the potential is different over here. It's just in a way that could have been duplicated by changing the fluxes over here. That's why we're not counting it again, you see. So it's not that the vacua are so dense in this space. It's because we have these many duality identifications.
So this is hiding the relevant direction, which is the flux space.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Oh. That's right, exactly. Oh, that's right. So they're not dense in that sense. So this is why. So ultimately, the answer is kind of what I started with, you know, with what Joe about. Because you got a lot of fluxes.
It is a projection of the actual the thing that's giving the vastness of the landscape here.
It's the flux.
It's the flux direction.
It's the flux.
You're projecting
that's
off,
right.
onto
that's
some
right.
much lower
that's
than
right.
subspace.
Yeah.
That's what's
right. That's right. So, okay. So, but it's still interesting to know for a given flux sector how many vacua there are. So that's something which it's not literally dividing out by this factor.
I mean, the fact that the number is not of order one really says that the Marx value has a really smooth distribution over these moduli, an excellent approximation.
Yeah. Okay, so So you can see from the discussion, I don't think I've quite said it the simplest way, but what I started off saying is right, that the number of fluxes is really what's going on in counting the number of vacua. Then there really is this sense in which duality would dramatically bring down the number, but then there is a sense in which the solving for the vacua compensates for that. So I think in the end, the this 1/5 to 24 is actually a relatively small correction. And that's the same thing with this problem. The L is not 50 or 100. So you do get this large number of
that. It's a hierarchy problem.
Okay. So that's the kind of story about these supersymmetric vacua. So now,
can I ask
how long should we? Yeah.
Maybe you're going to talk about the non-supersymmetric particle 0 1, but do you also want to use the index events for that one?
No, because how long should I go? Or we could just stop at some point and continue in some more informal way.
I will talk. 3:15.
Okay. So now V prime equals 0. Okay, so now the main thing about V prime equals 0 is that you can do this. You can do this, but for the interesting, you also have to do this, which is to say that you exclude vacua where there are tachyons. And once you do this, then this guy is guaranteed to be positive also. Okay, so So in fact, we do effectively compute the number of vacua to the extent we can compute that.
Minimum.
And how does this equation look? Okay, well, it's confusing. Now, one kind of simple point which it helps to have firmly fixed in mind at the beginning is that when you're computing these densities, everything is going on at that point in field space Z-tau. So you don't need to know the function. You just need to know W, K, dW, dK, and so forth at that point Z-tau. You just need to know some finite number of derivatives there and nothing else. So let's change variables to, pick a point z tau that we're going to compute this at, and now change variables from the original set of fluxes f and h through this formula to w at the point z tau f, which is diw, that's a z tau, the usual thing. And we'll also effectively set e to the k equals 1. Okay, you can think of it being a hidden e to the k over 2 in all of these formulas where you can say, well, there's some Taylor Boschian approximation that sets e to the k at z tau to 1. So this is also there, but I won't say it explicitly. Okay, now it's going to turn out to look at this constraint. We're going to need up to 3 derivatives of w. Okay, so now let's look at the equations the UIV and UIVJ. And at the point Z tell me, all right, well, okay, well, this is just transcribing Wes and Dagger. If you, strange to say, there's a mistake in Wes and Dagger, but anyhow, it's transcribing what they want to say. And this is Z i minus 2 w star w star i. Okay, and then this guy is useful to write in terms of a matrix. So this has terms of order f to the 0, f to the 1, f to the 2. Let me first make some comments about this one, and then I'll write this one down. Okay, so this is just the standard formula with the VWs and the d squared Ws and things, having made this change of variables. And what becomes obvious once you do it is that the problem of solving this thing equals 0 is the is basically the equation that some matrix has an eigenvector. Okay, so the matrix is something constructed with Z and W, and the eigenvector is something constructed using F. And you can make that a little more simple by making a small change of variables that absorbs the phase of W into this thing. And having done that, then there's a matrix, which is basically the fermion mass matrix. Which is Hermitian. And so you're just looking for a null vector, eigenvector of this matrix. So equivalently, a eigenvector of this matrix with eigenvalue 2W. Okay, so basically it's to say that you're looking for a mass matrix, a fermion mass matrix that allows for a Goldsteiner. You know, having written things in these conventions, the Goldsteiner is not massless, it's just a form where it has this mass. Of course, it mixes with the Gravitino, so it isn't its physical mass, but formally it has this mass 2W. And then that's the only condition to solve this equation. Now, just finding an app-breaking vacuum is the problem of having this Goldsteiner, which is a problem of does a matrix have an eigenvector? And well, the answer is yes, matrices have eigenvectors. And tuning the fluxes, you can tune W and the matrix pretty generically. So this says that at this stage, F-breaking vacuum are totally generic. You know, there's no difficulty in finding F-breaking vacuum. You know, it's not immediately what you would have thought, but they're very generic.
Okay. With minimal Kalman potential, they're all local maxima. None of them are local minima.
Right, now we should ask about whether you need to get this. Okay, so now in terms of this matrix, the bosonic mass matrix is this. So you can work it out. I think this is the example. And so this is the mass formula in supersymmetric ABS that goes on from the on mass relation unitaries order F and F squared correction. Okay, so now you have to of course start asking, well, what actual W's and F's and Z's and things do you get? And the pretty part of this problem is that you can make the following change of variable, which Frederick discovered. If you change from under the integral from df dh, okay, that was 2 D3 real variables to the variables of W at the point, some point Z tau, Fi for all the, you know, F terms at that point, and then Z0 I not equal to 0, and 0 is a dilaton. Okay, then this is the same number of real variables. It's D3 complex variables, and the Jacobian for this change of variables is 1. Okay, so the integral over the fluxes just becomes, you know, integral D2W B2N plus 1 E2N V0 I, and then the tadpole constraint becomes L is greater than or equal to W squared minus F squared plus these components of Z squared. Okay, so that becomes simple also. And so you can, you know, it's a simple thing of a posture, you know, we just compute it explicitly. And you can see the positive definiteness in the case that you have supersymmetry. And now you can see that the constraint's not positive definite when you break supersymmetry. So in principle, it could be an infinite number of vacua at this point. But you also observe that suppose you put a upper bound on the supersymmetry breaking scale, certainly, again, phenomenologically reasonable. And physically, once you get up to the Planck scale, anywhere near the Planck scale, you wouldn't trust any of this stuff. You might as well put an upper bound, you know, well below that, so you can trust any of this. Then move to the other side, and you can see again that it's bound to this. So there's going to be a finite number of vacua for the same reason, having put this bound on the supersymmetry breaking scale. Okay, so you get these, and then the other ones are determined in terms of spectral geometry. So here's the formula for disease in terms of the Yukawa coupling at some point Z. These are some of the more complicated formula for the EVs and so forth. So you have everything you need. And you see that, again, neglecting things about flux quantization, the W's are independent of the S, are independent of at least a subset of the Z, but of course the whole Z matrix satisfies this type of constraint. There are just, you know, n complex parameters for the n plus 1 squared matrix elements, and so forth. Okay, so it is true that you have a lot of freedom to vary this matrix, and you can vary the W. So it is true at this point that you can easily find D prime equals zero vacua. Now the generic thing to happen at this point is that this matrix, well, for an interesting vacuum, okay, now we're going to say, you know, we really want the vacua where the supersymmetry breaking scale is small, both so we trust it and phenomenologically. I mean, we can still study high-scale vacua. You know, if this comes out to be 10 to the minus 5, and that's a high-scale vacuum, you may well still trust, you know, the analysis that we're doing. And we're going to want W squared, 3W squared, or Z squared, in the cosmological constant away. So that's going to be small, too. And so we're looking for a matrix with a small eigenvalue. And the generic way to get that is just between 1, to imagine that one of the eigenvalues are becoming small, and all the others are what you want. So most of the structure of the potentials still up at the scale of the flux potential, which is basically the string scale times L. And you know, if you were in sufficiently big volume, that would still be below the Planck scale, and you would trust us. And then in that regime, things are approximately supersymmetric. You know, we have a big, you know, fermion mass, W small, all this stuff is small. So you don't get instability from the supersymmetric part of the theory. And the only thing you have to look at for the stability condition are the, quote, partners of the Goldsmith, the two bosons that for which, you know, W is small. Okay, so the stability analysis becomes very easy, which is not to say we got it right the first time. But it wasn't that hard to fix it up. This was pointed out to us by Michael Dine and his students, Shay and Ram, that you now look at this, and you have to, well, let's just, you know, suppose for sake of argument that, you know, the n is, you know, this term is small. Okay, well, this term is now going to dominate. Well, this, you know, and, you know, we're now looking at the 2W eigenvalue, so this really is zero. And now this term always has equal and opposite plus minus eigenvalues just from the form of this matrix. So at this point, you're guaranteed to have this backing it, I guess is the type of result you're alluding to. And the only way you can get rid of tachyon is by compensating with this term. So you can't have the minimal failure potential. You have to have this curvature be positive. Okay. But what do you have to do? Well, you had to tune F to be small, you know, definition of the class of vacuum you're looking for. You have to tune W to be small, so it cancels the cosmological constant eventually. And now if you look at this equation, you know, the R has to be positive order one. That's some fraction of the modulized state, but that's an order one fraction in the simple examples we did. And you have to get this term to be dominating this term, which means that U has to be of order F also. Okay, and then that's it. You know, once you've done that, then it is generic to find stable, non-supersymmetric vacuum. Okay, so now, basically, you can summarize this as saying that you had to tune the first four Taylor coefficients of the expansion of the superpotential in this one field partner equals n. So n had a small eigenvalue that was z of order 2w. W you had to tune, but that's like tuning the cosmological constant, and that's kind of the generic thing in all of these problems. And then you had to tune a component of f, an eigenvalue of z, a component of u, all to be of order this f. Okay, and then generically, these guys just come out uncorrelated. Okay, and to the extent that they're just uncorrelated, you have to tune them all. What you find is that the final distribution of vacua as a function of this upraking scale goes as f to the 5 df, just from tuning f df, because f is a complex parameter. Now, z is a complex parameter, it's like another f squared, and u is a complex parameter, it's another f squared. Okay, so you find at the end this distribution, which is heavily weighted towards the high scale. Okay, and we were kind of surprised by this for some time. Now, the...
Can you understand this very simply as saying, I want to write down an effective theory for the would-be guy who's breaking the suit. So I have to write down w equals some small coefficient times x, plus something times x squared, plus something times x squared.
Yeah, that's right. You just have to tune these small coefficients separately, and the point is that the structure a priori, at the level we got, we didn't get any, they're complex variables. The signs aren't really important, but the point is that so far we haven't assumed any structure that ties these guys together. So you just have to make these tunings independently, and that's what's making it so hard.
What's critical, I mean, you need a correction in the Taylor potential because
yeah, but generically, the Taylor potential is never canonical, never this minimal one. So that's easy to brush. Again, it's, you could ask more precisely, what fraction of the modulized space has this positive.
That is how you're doing that. So so like Taylor potential like x dagger x minus x dagger x squared or something like that on the order.
Yeah, exactly. That's
you're
right.
Just tuning all coefficients.
Yeah, that's right. And
you just have to start with the x cubed term because once you get that to work out.
That's it. That's all you see for stability. Okay, so this kind of meta stability. That's right. So it's an easy result to understand. And now, of course, what you say is, this is kind of stupid because the interesting supersymmetry breaking is the one which ties these guys together and makes the whole structure of the potential of supersymmetry breaking down at the low scale. So that's the thing you have to look for, and it could be there in the Calabi example. But we looked around a bit. And not having proven it doesn't exist, we suspect it does not exist, or it's not in any sense generic. And the basic reason being that although it is generic to get these small coefficients, in W and Z and so forth, what you also find very generically are small stuff plus order one. Okay, so if you look at, for example, the two periods in this problem, the other one you might have said, Z log Z, well, that's small. You got two coefficients instead of one. But you do the calculation, what you really get is some order one constant plus z log z, and then that kind of sloth is always there in the problem. And we could not find an example, any mechanism that would get rid of it. It's sort of because there are these extra supergravity terms in the potential that you just have to turn away at the end of the day. And it could be that some sufficiently complicated Calabi geometry makes this generic. But within the kind of limited looking around, we did not find a way you could accomplish such a thing. Okay, now let me come back to that issue and make another comment, which is that there was a paper that I wrote some time ago. And more or less the same time as Lenny Susskind wrote a paper arguing that, well, you know, it is true that you can, you know, tune W to be very small, order one over the number of vacua, basically because you're, you know, just adding relatively, you know, independent different contributions of these different, you know, cycles, hidden sectors, what you want, you know, what you will. Okay, let's compare that with the case of supersymmetry breaking. In the case of supersymmetry breaking, you have many different contributions from many different hidden sectors, and they all add positively. And there's not this kind of cancellation. And whenever you break supersymmetry in some sector, that's it, you break supersymmetry. So if there's any kind of sizable uniform component in the distribution in the hidden sectors, then you're going to get some huge population of high-scale vacua. Okay, so now we can come back and say, well, you know, is that argument borne out at this level? And what does that correspond to? Well, basically, it corresponds to the possibility that, you know, you integrate over more than one component of F in finding distribution. And that might be possible, but it would require that you have a degenerate eigen value of the sum. So you're saying that, you know, say there's a two-parameter family of these solutions, that's because there's a degenerate. You know, there are two eigenvalues with the same value double. You need to integrate over the coefficients of both, and those are the two components of F and so forth. So that is a possibility, and it's exactly the possibility of having degenerate eigenvalues of this matrix, you know, sort of more than one candidate full schema, so you can superpose them and you get this you know, higher dimension branch of vacua that will have a growth even faster than that.
Also, if you have some pinch up CP symmetry, I mean, you're just assuming that everything is complex,
right,
and that you have uncorrelated scanning for real and imaginary parts, but some. But
yeah, that's an interesting.
Some CP symmetry can turn that into easily turn that into a lower power. It might in fact turn into FDF. I remember looking at this and
Okay, that's an interesting unconnected observation. We're not talking about the possibility of getting at this higher power.
Right.
And so now you ask, well, you know, how often do you get the degenerate eigenvalues over here? And actually, again, if you start looking at simple examples, you find that they do happen. So, for example, T6 mod Z2 grad Z2, you find degenerate eigenvalues. But if you, it seems to be something special, you know, that's a highly symmetric example. And if you take the generic matrix of this type, you take the T6 mod Z2 grad Z2 and just start adding little perturbations to it, then you get into what is a more generic family of matrices, and what we would expect is that this is basically going to be governed by the behavior of generic matrices in the symmetry class. Okay, so this is a specific symmetry class. If you took the Z to be a complex symmetric matrix, which is all you are guaranteed in general, where each eigenvalue has a Gaussian distribution, say, then you would get an ensemble, which is called, in this matter, the C1 ensemble. It's not one of Wigner's, but this was introduced by Altland and Sernbauer, not, 15, 20 years ago. This is what comes out in mesoscopic systems if you have both time reversal and a spin symmetry. You get the symmetry constraints, which in that context give you this type of matrix. So it's not that hard to find the likelihood of degenerate eigenvalues. Okay, so if this had been a generic Hermitian matrix, you would know that the degenerate eigenvalues are suppressed in the sense that you have to tune three parameters. You know, instead of just one, you have to tune three parameters to get an eigenvalue degeneracy. So familiar from quantum mechanics. Now, it's actually easier in this class of matrices, but you still have to tune two parameters to get one degeneracy. I can, if you write the change of variables to the eigenvalues, you find that the measure looks like product lambda r minus lambda j squared to the one power one, and then product to lambda r squared. And we always have eigenvalues paired with equal and opposite sign. So the degeneracy is at this extra codimension one. Okay, and so you then go through, and it turns out that indeed for this generic branch, this thing which is the leading L behavior, there are such things, but they will be a lower, they will be a lower dimensional subspace of the moduli space. So for this kind of generic analysis, they count zero. Okay, unless so generic, given again this kind of generosity argument, you will not get these coincident branches, and the following the previous argument, was claiming that the different epsilons were independently distributed. Now you see that, well, now there really is this kind of level repulsion at the level, and then the generic mass matrix that prevents them from being independently distributed. Except, you know, there's always these, you know, loophole degeneracy arguments. You know, for example, suppose the M were a sum of two commuting matrices. Well, then it would be generic. You know, then you would just have to tune one parameter, and then you would find these vacua, again, showing up with number comparable to the original vacua. Okay, and so physically, to summarize all this, you know, there could be, well, limits of Calabi-Yau modulized space where it can really factorize it in some strong way. And as you approach these limits, and this really doesn't talk to that, it would be true that the supersymmetry breaking over here would be independent of that. You would get the phenomenon I described, and you would get an even faster growth. You would get supersymmetry breaking over here independent of that, and you would get this kind of uniform component. So it's, the argument is actually has an element of truth in it. Okay, but as far as we got, again, we didn't, you know, see the structure that would literally make it true. Okay, so then to conclude, you can also say some things about the D-term breaking, but not so precisely because we don't have such a clear Ansatz. But you can see, for example, that you know, if you say I'm going to break supersymmetry a la KKLT, I'll put an anti-brain down some thread, try to stabilize the thread, and see if all this works together. You find that it does, and you would get a population of D-breaking vacua with just distribution DD. You know, so that guy would have the uniform distribution that you might have guessed, and then that would be, or even stronger, you know, because now you can use this type of behavior to enhance the number of, you know, vacua down these threads. So it sounds like the conclusion of this analysis is that you know, F-breaking is hard and D-breaking is much easier, but the, you know, a valid D-breaking vacuum has to turn the cosmological constant to zero and has to avoid tachyons. And now, in the generic D-breaking vacuum, suppose you have some large D. Now, generically, you'll drive an F, but generically, you'll drive an F which is much smaller than the D. And then what you find is that you're going to always get tachyons because there's this minus 2W squared. There's this universal tachyonic thing in the bosonic mass matrix. And in the F-breaking vacuum, this always compensates it because it's 3W squared. But in a primarily D-breaking vacuum, this doesn't compensate it. And you just generically get tachyons. So in fact, I don't think you can get these predominantly D-breaking vacuum. You just have to, again, two things to get the F and the D comparable. So the status of that, in my mind, is very unclear whether you can literally just use that anti-breaking. Yeah, you know, yeah, that's right. All these things are kind of, to some extent, old results. You know, we gradually, you know, definitely you can find these comments in the old papers. I'm not quite sure what to say we discovered and what we just reformulated, but I really say that we have a more systematic way of deriving and presenting all these old results. So,
where does it run to? Does it run to a Suzy
F? Yeah, probably. It does generically. Okay, so finally, what about this question of finding something where these guys are correlated? And so you get a F-breaking vacuum without this heavy tuning penalty. Okay, well, you would say the conventional scenario where you have dynamical breaking through the gauge sector, surely that produces a new component. You know, there's some, you know, field within the gauge theory. You generate a superpotential for it. It's all going to be set by the low scale of the gauge theory. So there's not this problem that you have to tune these separately, and so that seems to be a, you know, reasonable way that won't lead to this kind of suppression. You know, at the worst, it would be this, or possibly even this. But now, you know, okay, I mean, I think everything I just said is quite reasonable. But you might have tried to say, well, you know, hey, there's this very general duality between gauge theories and flux. You know, so let's just take this gauge theory that we've just constructed, and let's just dualize it into flux. You know, I mean, we don't know that we can always do this, but certainly there are, you know, huge numbers of examples. You know, it seems to be fairly general. I could have hypothesized that I could always dualize it into a flux, and then I would decide it didn't work. Okay, so which argument should I believe? And there are various ways out of this. Okay, so one possibility is that, well, this is actually the correct argument, because why didn't it work? It wasn't a problem in the gauge theory. It was a problem with these sort of, you know, extra supergravity in these terms, and if you were really careful about deriving the gauge theory, you would find it's there. So that might turn out. Another possibility is that, well, you can't always dualize these things in their flux. You know, there's some obvious, you know, condition beyond which you can't go. For example, suppose you have a chiral gauge theory. I mean, the cases that were really worked out, the superpotential was worked out in detail, are non-chiral theories. That's, you know, just happens to be, and maybe you can't do this duality for chiral theories. You know, there are various loopholes you could try to cite. Maybe, you know, this assumption is wrong, and this is a strong coupling statement, and this is not the Cayley potential in the, you know, the real physical, you know, gauge theory. So there are various reasons that, you know, flaws in the argument, but I do want to propose the argument as an interesting kind of a, not paradox, but, you know, contradiction within, you know, if you try to take the pictures of duality that we have and just kind of, you know, extend them maximally, you start running into contradictions of this type, you know, which suggests, you know, well, you know, not all extensions are right, you know, you can think about, you know, where is the correct loophole in there, you know. Okay, so I guess it's cookie time now. I didn't have any time for 2 and 3, so I'll just let people decide, after if they want me to continue or not. And I'll stop for the moment.